Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points you're interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make, if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information provider is paying this director for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quick likely deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very much for your introduction and your disclaimer. It's greatly appreciated. Ladies and gentlemen, for every call that we do in the beginning, if we have new callers, first-time callers, we always go through the short list and ask for their first name only to associate with a phone number that they're calling in on. If you're not comfortable giving your actual first name, that's okay. Make up one. I don't care. I just need to be able to associate a name with a phone number. And the reason for this is because I have been marketing people I call information providers for nearly three decades. Well, I tell you what, time passes fast. And in that time, I have watched others who do what I do be indicted by a grand jury and face charges of practicing law without a license and go to jail. We're very, very clear on these calls that if you're here for legal advice or financial advice, to hang up and leave the call. Contact someone in your state that is licensed to give legal advice or financial advice. You're not going to find it here. What you will find here are men and women who are, as Jefferson said, quote, knowledgeable in the law and well-disposed to using it, end quote. And they will share with you, under the given circumstances that you've presented, what they might do where they're similarly situated. That's all. And it's up to you to determine whether that's something that you want to do or not. Anyway, so we'll start with a first-time caller from Sacramento, California. The number is ending in 00039. If I may have just your first name only, please, if I can get this board to unmute you. Give me, yeah, there you go. And just your first name only, please.
Can you hear me?
No, I did not. Could you try again, please? Make up a name if you like. I don't care.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can hear you very well. All right.
Great.
I don't have an issue with my name, Don.
Okay, thank you, Don. I appreciate that. My screen has just refreshed, and it's an antiquated machine, so it'll take me a minute before I can put you in there and go to the next one, Don. While we're waiting for this, let me just share with everyone that the calls that you listen to on Saturday night are about how you can arrange your affairs in such a way that you own absolutely nothing. You're as poor as a church mouse. You could even take a declaration of pauper if you wanted to. but you control everything. You could live on that beach house and have that Maserati for that you tool around in, but you don't own it. A trust owns it and things like that. The Monday night call is the same thing, but in regards to your flesh. In the United States, there are actually two classes of citizens. And we learn that one of those citizens exists at the pleasure of the Congress. They're created by the Congress. It's a special class of citizenship, which is further magnified in what we call the 14th Amendment. And then the other class of citizenship in the United States Code, it's expressed as a American national. And in the IRS, an older W-8 Ben form, they listed them as Union State citizens. So that's the Monday night call. Tonight's call is, in general, the application of those two tools, if you would, those two arrows in your quiver. And what John shares with you is how to leverage those in any particular case that you may have. Let me go back to Sacramento one more time, sir, and because I was talking and I forgot your name. I'm sorry. Is it Don?
That's okay. Don. It's Don.
Don. Okay. D-O-N. Gotcha. Thank you. Update. And the next is from Huntington Beach, California, ending in 6879. If I may have just your first name only, please.
Nicholas.
Thank you, Nicholas. I appreciate you. Give me one second here. I'm just going to have to write this on a notepad because it's not behaving right now.
I don't know if you can still hear me, but it's N-I-C-O-L-A-S.
Okay. I just dumped the H. Excellent. Thank you, sir. All righty. So tonight we're going to be talking with John, and John's passion is actually the art of litigation and the strategies that are developed. So it's a wonderful opportunity that you have to talk with a litigator in this process and a strategist on how to best arrive at the end results of your need that you may have at that time. Specifically tonight is a courtroom class on procedures. He will be using an actual IRS case, a case study that he has been employed with, and he will be sharing that. So anyone that has a pending or a current IRS matter, or even perhaps had one historical, this call is for you tonight. So with that having been said, I want to also and lastly remind you that tomorrow night is another live call with a new information provider who deals with a turnkey business arrangement. In other words, you have this business that you're presently operating, or one perhaps that you're going to create this year and start a new business with. With this turnkey business operation, he can show you, for less than $10,000, how to properly arrange this to begin with, where basically the taxing is stripped from it, and give you the option of even further reinforcing it by having the membership of this LLC that is crafted for you. The membership of this LLC, the partners, actually being in the IRS's vernacular, quote, a non-taxpayer. So that's what's on the table for tonight and for tomorrow night. And it's my pleasure at this time to turn the call over to John. Go ahead, John.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you for your kind and gracious introduction.
Pleasure.
Everyone faces a consideration that someday they might find themselves in tax court. To that end, there's an old saying, it says, when you find yourself out with your brother, settle with him on the way to court, lest he hand you over to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the jailer, and you not be released until you've paid every last penny. And my humble apologies, I have a frog in my throat this evening, and I have a little bit of a sore throat. But to that end, it's my pleasure to always try to resolve the matter before it ends up in litigation or ends up in court. But in the hopefully unlikely event that you end up in court, it's also important to prepare you the cussing and discussing of your matter before a bench. And to that end, it's vitally important that you know exactly how to proceed, especially in this case. We're going to use an IRS case that is actually a current case. It was one that was this year, that as a case study to learn from. Now, when we're opening remarks with the etymology of a lawsuit or a prosecution is that first, if it's a criminal prosecution, they do an investigation on you, and you usually don't know that the investigation is occurring. Then what they do is, after that investigation is occurring, and you will rarely ever know the investigation is in play. What they do is they take, if they feel they have substantial enough evidence, they'll go to seek a grand jury hearing. And what they do is that just like in small claims court or just JP court, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, when you when you file a complaint, or if it's a tax, or if it's a traffic case, they'll file what's called a probable cause statement, or you'll file a verified complaint with an affidavit. Now remember, your affidavits of critically prime importance, because affidavits are evidence of testimony and evidence that is admitted into the court, regardless of what the pleadings are. The statements you make in an affidavit are vitally important, because that's evidence that's on the record that they must consider when any deliberations occur, or if they turn the deliberations over to a jury. So it's very important that when you're the moment that you know something's coming against you, if you have points or statements that you of fact that you're prepared to make, that, and I'm going to use a big word here, exculpatory, and the term exculpatory means that it's evidence that could prove your innocence. Okay, hang on a moment. I'm going to grab something to drink. Now, prosecutors, respecting and regretting, have come to the place where they, like any other employee, like to impress their employers. So what happens is that they like to win cases. When they don't win, their employers, the federal prosecutor, the state prosecutor, the county prosecutor, you know, the district attorney, or, you know, when the assistant district attorneys, and district attorneys rarely ever personally prosecute cases. It happens. And the same way, with attorney generals. It's usually the deputy attorney generals that prosecute the cases. But what happens is that they'll go find all the evidence they can, and they work very hard. And in some cases, they expend an unbelievable amount of resources. And to the point where in this one case that I'm using as a case study for this evening, the defendant, the judge told him he couldn't say that in his opening remarks, and the defendant just kept right on saying it. And the defendant says, turned around and says, "Your Honor, the opening remarks are my opening remarks. I appreciate the prosecutor's objections. However, he has no standing to object to my this is how I'm setting the table for my case, is how I'm setting the table." And the judge says, "No, I'll tell you what you can." I says, "Object, Your Honor. I'm sorry. This, it's all about me." He started to talk again. The judge was so angry that the judge broke his gavel while banging it, because the gentleman continued to talk. But the judge demanded immediately that both the prosecutor and the defendant, who was representing himself pro se in court, he demanded that they approach the bench, and then he demanded them in chambers. And he says, "Look, I told you couldn't." He says, this is my time to say what I want. You know, if you don't want me to make my opening statement, throw me in jail and postpone the hearing." And the prosecutor says, "Objection, Your Honor." And this was in chambers. "We can't do that. We've spent too much money. Everything's ready to go. I can't afford for this guy to sit in jail one day while this trial has a continuance and we're holding all the jurors, etc." He says, "I'm going to fine you $5,000. He says, "No, you're not. You're depriving me of my civil rights under color of law." He says, "I don't think you're going to do that." Well, actually, he said, "I don't think you're going to do that." And the judge says, "I could." He says, "But you won't, because that would constitute a felony on your part for depriving me of my civil rights under color of law. And that would also mean that your 19 years, 3 months, 2 weeks, and 2 days of tenure would evaporate instantaneously under your criminal prosecution." And the judge says, "What?" And the defendant, when he accounted, he says, the judge didn't say another word. He says, "We're going back into court now." And he finished his opening statement. Okay. But there's what happens is that after they do this investigation on you, and they're going to go to a grand jury of between 13 and 23 persons, depending on the geographical locale. Now, California has reduced the grand jury to nothing more than a political action committee, practically. But the Constitution is very clear. If anybody's going to be attempted to be indicted on an offense that could be a capital offense or more than $10,000, that they have to have a grand jury indictment. And that means that just not one person. If it's a traffic case or you're in civil court, like JP court, et cetera, when you decide to complain about somebody else or you're doing an eviction or whatever, the guy bent your fender when he backed into you, it's only you making the complaint that somebody did either civil damages or criminal damage to you, criminal injury. And so what happens is that the this is just that person by themselves. But if it's a heinous crime, the Constitution requires that a group of individuals be convinced by some level of evidence, and the rules of evidence for grand jury proceedings is much different than the rules of evidence for actual trial. It's not near, they don't have near the requirement for filing the for a grand jury hearing that they do for filing for a criminal trial. To that end, sometimes the prosecutor is even in possession of exculpatory evidence and doesn't bring it before the grand jury. We're presently aware of quite a few cases where exculpatory evidence was available. They ignored it. The individual prosecuted the case, won, and she ended up getting one walloping heck of a promotion. She was using the case as a stepping stone to further her career. To that end, she had to do a lot of damage control out the back door, and meaning that she had to cover up the crime or the mistakes. And to that end, you've probably heard there's no such thing as a perfect crime. And in her case, there wasn't either. And what happened was that that one, we're still going through that, finding all of the acts, the criminal acts that she committed, and it's necessary to find those. Those cases are harder to work through. But what happens is that the moment they hand down a grand jury indictment, if they're able to convince 13 or more of those 23 or the jurors in that jury pool can be 13 to 23. The reason why it's 13 and not 12 is so that if there is a dissenting individual, that they're required to have 12 assenting votes. And that way, or if one person gets sick, they can still have, quote unquote, 12 assenting votes. But at this juncture, what happens is that with 23, if you get just a little over half or a majority of your jurors, you've got a grand jury conviction or a grand jury indictment. Now what happens is that when they've got that grand jury indictment, they go before the a judge and they say, look, here's what's happening. Here's the charges. And we reviewed it with the grand jury and they agreed that, these charges are valid and ready to prosecute and ready to file. And the judge takes that and issues, based on those statements, unlike previously when it was a probable cause statement, when it was only one person. In this case, it's a minimum of 13 individuals, possibly as much as 23, depending on state to state. And they issue a warrant for that individual's arrest, they bring you in, and you have to post bond, depending on the type of case, how much, et cetera, was weighed. Now, during the following time, they allow you to prepare for trial. And in this case, they gave the individual 90 days to almost 90 days to prepare for trial. There's a handful of things to prepare. There's jury instructions, meaning on what aspects of the law they will be instructed to note. And usually the government's very forceful about this. You have the right to object to any jury instruction that they give. And they, most of them, especially the Fifth, Sixth, and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, have published jury instructions that with which a prosecutor can pool that, from with which they can shoot. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're automatically accepted. But for good cause, you can say, hey, this instruction is not constitutional or doesn't apply in this situation. So what happens is that you can take the situation and make some changes in your favor. Now, the thing that's very important is that the jury instructions, that's exactly what the judge is going to give the jury when he's commending them to at the beginning of the case. So it's very important that you pay attention to the jury instructions. Very, very important. In fact, in certain cases, it can make all the difference in certain circumstances whether your case, whether you win or lose it. Most cases are won or lost during the opening actions before the court is convened, before the case comes to trial. And I say that because they set the table in such a way that prosecutors have gotten good enough that they set the table in such a way that a defendant can't win. There's a motion called motion in limine, meaning that they try to limit what you can produce as evidence before the jury. And this is a way that they repeatedly and unconstitutionally take away your rights. What they do is they take the defenses that you may propound in advance and write them into a motion in limine so that the jury doesn't hear it. And this there's two cases in the last 12 months where IRS cases where an individual, they wrote motions in limine that precluded any defense, any and every defense that both of these two were prepared to mount and that were clearly valid defenses any point in those cases would have gotten the defendant off. And so what happens is that when it gets this bad and the judge has gone that far, there have to be ways to work around that. And there are. One of them is, as I was talking about that one case, when he was doing his opening remarks, and judge says, "You can't say that, you know." Yeah, you say I can't talk about the law, but this is my case. These are my opening statements. And there's something also called voir dire, V-I-O-R-D-I-O-R, voir dire, D-O-I-R. And what happens is that these are the questions that you use during jury selection. And what happens is that during jury selection, now they demand that everybody submit their voir dire. And so what happens is that they don't want to asking the jury because questions that could seed or direct the jury toward a certain path. And to that end, they're starting to realize that defendants are using the voir dire as an asset tool to actually start the commence the their thought the thought provoking moments on the trial. And as that goes on, what happens is that they have a pool of questions they ask the juries for jury selection to either validate or deny one. And in this particular case, some of the voir dire was, do you pay income tax? Why? Do you know? Have you read the income tax, chapter 26 of the income tax code for, the United States code? Do you know that there is no statute that requires you to physically pay federal income tax? And at that point, the judge erupted and said, I'm going to disallow that. And, he says, Your Honor, I have the right to ask the jury anything, to determine whether I qualify them or not. And it's me that's qualifying them because it's my trial. And they, and once again, he demanded, the defendant in to Chambers first before the bench, and he got so upset that he demanded the defendant in Chambers. And after that, they came out, and the gentleman was there and says, the judge said he's going to fine me $10,000. And I told him, I says, put that in writing. He says, what do you mean? He said, put it in writing, because I'm immediately going up to the U.S. District Court of Appeals for deprivation of civil rights under color of law or policy, practice, or procedure, and we're filing a complaint against you immediately. He refused to put it in writing. He still is claiming that the defendant, that trial is still going, actually. He's still claiming that the defendant is going to be charged with that and have to pay that. And he's also filed a contempt of court charge for 90 days for not quote-unquote filing discovery. But that's another thing. During the beginning of your court procedure, you'll be filing what is called discovery, meaning that you'll ask questions of the opposing party for answers that they will be required to deliver up. So that you have that evidence so that you can prepare your witness list, et cetera, et cetera. In many cases, they use the discovery to figure out what your plan of action is, and they try to just like you are using the discovery to find out what their plan of action is. They're also using it, yours, to find out what your plan of action is and what your defense is. And as bad as what I'm about to say sounds, they consider this almost a contest or a sport or a game. And they consider this a adversely competitive environment, and it's both ferocious and vicious. And it's very important that you walk circumspectly and wise as serpents and innocent as doves. And don't let them get you excited or angered under any circumstances. That's of extremely prime importance, that you do not allow yourself to become angered or upset about their bad behavior. And trust me, it's extremely easy to become angered or upset about how bad their behavior is, because their behavior is very, very bad in some cases. The fact that they have taken something that is supposed to be a mechanism of justice for the benefit of all the people, etc., and turned it into something that's almost literally a blood sport, they're adversely competitive, and you can see some of these prosecutors, the way they handle things when they during their election campaign, because they talk about how many cases they've won, and they brag about it, and they talk about their conviction or their conviction ratio, and I even had one prosecutor and one judge both use the term kill ratio before they corrected themselves into conviction ratio, meaning of cases that have come before them that they claim they're serving the people by the amount of convictions that they successfully make. And it's interesting that the judge, over half the judges out there, believe they're doing something good by a high conviction rate that comes before them. They say, which paraphrase underscore closed caption in parentheses at the bottom of TV screen, they're saying the prosecutors are bringing good cases. I'm just making sure they're getting convicted. And it's not a case of the prosecutors getting good cases always. It's them making convictions. I'm going to grant me a moment's grace. And so what happens is that we find that the bench is already biased long before the grand jury indictment that was served on them to be converted to a warrant, that they're already thinking convict, convict, convict. And to that end, there's a handful that I'm personally aware of that one of them, we just had her removed from office 3 weeks ago, tactfully through through some very tactful pleadings, and we felt that it was clear that she was going to act a certain way, and we made certain that one case ended up in her court, and we filed a complaint in advance to the U.S. District Court of Appeals for judicial misconduct, and we filed it the day the trial started. And of all things, lo and behold, she started on the case exactly as everybody suspected she was. Unbeknownst that her protector at the U.S. District Court of Appeals level didn't have time to call her and tell her to ease up before she started committing some bad behavior. And by the time they called her, she actually was ready to resign that day, literally, because we filed it. We waited till the court, till the trial started, and then quietly filed. And she didn't have any chance to get away from the bench to be informed of what had been filed against her. And she was very initially in court, very open and very proud and very aggressive about what she was doing and the way she was doing it. And so to that end, it was a that one was a situation where we let the justice hang herself. And it was important that it was handled that way so that we didn't have to make the case. There's when you go through voir dire, that's where you're choosing the jury selection. You can ask questions that are germane to the case and choose your jurors. Picking your jurors is very important. Certain times you don't want certain things occurring in the jury, and there's times where you may not want somebody that is familiar with a personal injury case, or because maybe you're representing a physician, and I was on a case like that. In fact, this year I was a juror on that, where they had, unbeknownst, they had picked three people that had personal injury issues, and this physician, unbeknownst to them, had done exactly the same thing that had two of these jurors had occurred in their background, and they didn't ask the right questions during jury selection. And to that end, these two jurors, there was no way this person, the plaintiff, was going to lose the case against the doctor that committed the malpractice. It was a done deal before the trial ever started because of the jury selection process. So paying attention on during a jury selection is very, very important. Get help when it comes to jury selection. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of a guy named O.J. Simpson. You probably are all too young to know about it. But the gentleman and the two women that participate, that they experts that they bought on board to assist in jury selection, got paid $3.5 million. Most people don't know that. That is not public knowledge. But they made a shiny nickel, which just suffice to say, they made a shiny nickel on helping out with jury selection. And the thing that was very critical is that they were going after the case, one aspect of it, by trying to choose the jury that they knew could win. And one of the board hour questions is, you ever watch pro ball? And they used the fact that some of these individuals were fans. Technically that's not legal. Of course, and again, technically it's their right to choose whatever juror they want to and ask whatever voir dire jury questions they choose to. So, the thing is, the takeaway on that is that, you can win or lose a case on jury selection. And among all the different things, each one of these at a certain case, can be a win or lose. Choosing the jury instructions, voir dire, the jury questions. Now your opening and closing statements, when it comes to, finally, you've chosen a jury and now you're going to commence the trial. And usually, a lot of times they'll have jury selection in the morning and trial in the afternoon, and you'll start your trial the same day. So what happens is that, you'll go right from jury selection into the trial, usually with a lunch recess. And, last how many that I've been through, that was exactly the way it proceeded. And you know what? If you get a jury summons, that's one of the few things that we have the honor and privilege of. Instead of one judge, there's 12. Now, a lot of the judges have come to the place where, and then man made God in his own image, many of them believe they literally are their responsibility, and they will tell you, look, you can't look up the law. That's exclusively what I give you. They believe they can legitimately, legally do that, when that is not the case. The responsibility of a juror, is now that there are 12 judges, not just one. And, to that end, the justices, for some reason, they've become convinced that, this issue about winning, is good. And, it's almost like a contest. And to that end, this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And the people don't have time, aren't able to, don't have the skills, don't feel safe or just choose not to, they hire help. FAA, U.S. or Forestry Service, longshoremen, truck people, presidents, judges, sheriffs. Oh, by the way, those last three, they're just temp help. And during the 8 hours that they are hired to work, they subordinate their civil rights to those on a fiduciary responsible basis, to those that they're serving. And they go up and they make an application for employment. They go get their 10,000 signatures or however it is, and then they let their employers choose who they're going to hire when it comes to a hiring opportunity. So remember that the judges are just hired help, and that you have recourse with the U.S. District Court of Appeals for complaints about judges, and you can file criminal complaints against them. Well, one thing about when you come to trial and it comes to opening arguments and closing arguments, like in an IRS case, and this, as Michael said, we were going to use a couple of these as case studies. Almost everyone except two of these that that we've used this opening argument have been won. And both of the two we didn't win, the judge prohibited the defendant from finishing his jury instructions. And in both cases, they didn't finish the jury instructions. And as sad as it is, they caved to the pressure to some degree. I'm glad that some of them didn't cave, but there are two that caved, and the cases, one of the big ones was not won. We're still working on the appeal for that individual. But one of the jury, you know, you say, you guys, if you open up with your opening statement, you've all heard about income tax, and, you know, and you probably, pay or don't pay, or, you know, and it's my bet that most of you don't realize that income tax is voluntary. In fact, the first three words of the federal statute, 26 U.S.C. 7203, are any person liable or responsible for the, and what happens is that it's like, whoa, holy kitty litter, Batman. You mean not everybody's required? And there's multiple places in the IRS code that state that. Now, if you pull that 26 U.S.C. 7203, and for those of you with IRS cases, please write that down, 26 U.S.C., and I'm not talking about the Trojans in California, United States code, but 26 U.S.C. 7203. There's a common code called 6203 where you ask the IRS to make its assessments and you proceed based on that. And the ones that use the defenses that use the 6203s, those are good defenses. And but we're going to cover a different one right now. But if you pull up when you types 26 U.S.C. 7203 in your search engine, you'll find that the Cornell Law is one of the first ones. It's one of the first three. And I recommend using Cornell Law or Legal Information Institute, LII. And I donate to them regularly, you know, through PayPal or credit cards, etc. Because it's a not-for-profit. But there's a hot link. Under the second word, person, any person liable, those are the first three words. You just, it clearly indicates that there are some individuals that are not required to pay income tax. So the word person has a hot link. It goes to 26 U.S.C., same basic chapter in the United States Code, but it's 7343, and write that down, please. 7343. These are both under 26 U.S.C., which is the income tax code, but look under 7343, and if you click on the link on the Cornell Law site, it'll take you right to it. But it defines a person, what specifically a person is. And not a man, not an organic individual, as defined by the Declaration of Independence, which is one of the highest governing documents. And Article 9 of the Bill of Rights to the Constitution says the rights enumerated here in the Constitution are not meant to disparage any already held by the people. It's indicating that there are superior rights. The Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the same one, just only seven away from the one that they like, the government likes to beat you over the head and say you got to pay income tax. But this one says there are superior rights. But in 7343, and I, by the way, did I mention 26 U.S.C. 7343? Oh, and I should probably mention United States Code 26, Chapter 7343. Oh, and I should probably remind you that, among other things, you should look up 26 U.S.C. 7343, along with 7203. Okay, and if, oh, and if I hadn't mentioned it, look up 7206 USC 7203 and 7343. Before I forget, I should probably remind you to look up 7343. But what happens is that it defines an individual, the person, not an organic man, and it talks about corporate entities that are not required to, or that are required to file income tax. In the opening statement, you say, you know, you tell them, you tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. And the same thing in the closing statement. But the prosecutor is going to bring up all these things that say that I earned income that was taxable, and they're going to bring up, people are going to testify about how much it is or what dates it happened. But that's all to no avail. No. The thing you want them to do is prove that I am responsible for paying income tax. Nowhere in the tax code, you will see this through the trial. And this is usually about the time the judge objects, and you have to ask him, Your Honor, this is my, I'm the one, I have opening statements here. And, you know, and if the judge starts yelling, you just keep talking. And, you know, they may grab, the bailiff may come over and grab you and intimidate you. Keep talking. They've spent money on this trial. They can't convict you without completing the trial. They are not going to delay the trial for a week while they put you in jail for a week. The judge may try to hold you in contempt and charge you, you know, a $5,000 or $10,000 fine. But if the case is exonerated, the fines go away. Okay. But what you do is you say, nowhere in the code in Chapter 26, does it make me liable for filing in or paying federal income tax? So what I want you to do is watch through the trial. If the prosecutor ever proves that, remember, unless he proves that first, that I'm liable, you cannot return a guilty verdict. They have to prove that I'm liable to return a guilty verdict. And when you're done, you say, hey, look, I told you up front that they could not provide a single statute that proved that I was responsible as a man, as an individual. And a lot of times judges get a little ticky about you quoting the United States Code, but just say under 26, and then in closing statement, just say under 26 U.S.C. 7203, it says any person liable, and on 7343 it defines, and you guys write that down, tell the jurors that, write that down, that under 26 U.S.C. 7343, it defines a person, and you just look to see if that's me, and you look to see, review your notes, did the prosecution ever prove that I was responsible for paying federal income tax. Okay, my time has come to a close. I've actually run 4 minutes over. My humble apologies. We've tried to condense not one but two subjects into one tonight. at least to give you a 40,000-foot overview. Further on in the upcoming conference calls and classes, we'll expound on each one of these. Obviously, this is just a start, but thank you for your patience. And a short reminder that while we do encourage you to stay on topic, on subject matter topic for your Q&As, you're not required to, you're not restricted to that. If you have a question on anything, you're free to bring that up. Thank you. Back to Michael.
Hey there, John. Thank you so very much. This was a great introduction on your part. Now you're getting to my favorite part, which is the Q&A. So to raise your hand so that I can identify you and unmute your phone and let you speak freely with John here. And frankly, this is a great opportunity. There's no cost for this, and it's the best time to start asking questions. Press star 2 on your keypad, star 2. It's the little asterisk underneath your number 7 on the keypad, star 2. And then that'll raise your hand, a hand on a board that I'm looking for that I mentioned earlier. For those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the center right of your monitor. You will see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side, empty inside. Click in there and type away your comment or question. Outside and underneath that rectangle laying on its side, you'll see a place to put your name and some other information and hit submit. Then it will populate on my end, and I'll be glad to give voice to your comment or question. Again, before we go to answer or have these questions or have this opportunity, I want to remind everyone of why we're here tonight and what you can look forward to for tomorrow night. On Saturday evening and on Monday evening, we have two information providers that focus on the former, the things that you have that you really need to divest yourself of in your name but still maintain complete and total control over. That's the Saturday call with Judge Bernie, Justice Beshear. And then the Monday night call with GW on how to identify the land jurisdiction and the personam jurisdiction of someone that is liable to the statutes, to the Code of Federal Regulations, the 50 codes. And you'd be surprised that, you know, how that works out. The reality is that almost every single one of you are misidentified as United States citizens, when in reality you are an American national, and in the old parlance from a former IRS form, you're referred to as a Union state citizen. You remember the Union, something that Lincoln wanted to preserve? Yep. There's two classes of citizenship, and so that's what the Monday night call is about. And then tomorrow night, very importantly, for any of you, whether you are an entrepreneur, you're going into business or not, you could be an employee. Maybe it's time to change your status as an employee to that of a worker, possibly for an LLC that goes to work for the company that you presently work for. These are the good things to learn from. So let us start with Michael, and then Jennifer, then Bill, then Kent, and then Johnny Ringo. I'm glad he's here. Go ahead, Michael.
Thank you. How's everybody this evening? Anyway, about how the judges operate, my daughter appeared before a judge for traffic, and she was asking him questions. He got irate, and he sent her to jail for 90 days for contempt. And in the process, he emptied the courtroom. He was screaming at her. He lost his cool. And then while she was in jail, he proceeded another ticket that she had paid the money to for whatever it was to appeal or the ticket or however it worked out, filing fee or something for $25. Anyway, it went before the same judge, and then he found her, since she wasn't in court, he found her guilty for it or ascertained a fine of $250 against her for it. But he knew where she was, and she told the jail that she had to go to court for this other ticket. And in the process, before all that happened, is when the police were there and all this started at her house because they thought her car was involved in something and it wasn't. They busted the window out. They didn't have a warrant. Then they searched the car and then they hauled the car off and she filed a replevins, I believe. Anyway, she filed motions and whatnot against them. And the city, the county, the court, they hauled her car off, and then the city sold her car. All in violation of the law, but they don't care about the law. You got to understand, these people are tyrants, and they're criminals. So, and that's where that stands. And she's still writing to the Supreme Court of Florida and to the Judicial Qualifications Committee and filing complaints on them, and to no avail because you're filing to the same people that are protecting them. So you have to be careful when you handle these people. And that's on a local level. God knows what the federal level is really criminal. Just look what they're doing to Trump. It's out of control. And if this was 1776 or 1800 or 1825, the people would have got it back in control back then using the Constitution. And that's not being a belligerent. Anyway, that's all I got to say for you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. There's a court case I'm going to find real quickly here. And for any traffic court case, I would just have to say, Your Honor, how does this court explain? And let me give it to you one second. I just had it. Here we go. Your Honor, how does this court explain Hendricks versus Maryland, SC Reporters RD, round 610 through 625? Quote, a U.S. citizen upon leaving the District of Columbia becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have the common law right to travel of a citizen of one of the several states. Has this court evidenced that I am a U.S. citizen? Has this court evidenced I am a resident? How did the law enforcement officer determine this when he was pulling up behind me with his red flashing lights? These determinations have not been made. They're foundational to jurisdiction. How do you explain this in moving forward against me without first establishing on the record that I am a United States citizen? Simple as that. Anyways, thank you. So let's go to the next question. The next caller is Miss Jennifer. Go ahead, Miss Jennifer.
Hi there, Michael and John. Hope you're having a good evening. Thanks for the calls. John, I was just wondering, does an IRS court have to prove jurisdiction before they can do a trial?
Yes.
Or did these people already have a contract with the IRS because they had signed their 1040 type things?
Jennifer, there's a handful of ancillary issues that we just didn't have the time to go into this evening. And the motion to quash for lack of in personam jurisdiction, presently in both of those cases, we realized that they don't understand jurisdiction and the court overruled it illegally on its own merit. Courts cannot determine its own jurisdiction must be argued, and there must be findings, facts, and conclusions of law. In both cases, they ran over it three times and threatened the defendant with criminal incarceration. In one case, the defendant was incarcerated for 14 days in U.S. District Court, in federal prison, for asking the question a third time and trying to explain it to him. We've realized that right now I'm under a little bit of a more of a workload than I'm comfortable with at the moment. But what's happening is that I'm working on a brief to explain jurisdiction and to the judge so that it becomes indefatigable, so that I'm passing it through some other folks to review that may have actually served on a bench at one time or another. And one of them pointed out, he says, you know, this is very good. He says, when I was serving, I didn't understand any of this. The other justice, while we were having lunch by a pool, he commented, says, yeah, I know it, but I would have lost the next election if I would have done anything about it. And it was like, and I literally said, holy K-litter, Batman, you know, and both of them looked at me and I says, you know, that's kind of a tough state of affairs when we get to the place where we can't grant justice because we either don't know or we know and our re-election is going to be heavily affected. And this gentleman, I have a little bit of grace with him because many years earlier, I had even been his paper boy back in the 60s. And and Leon and I got to know each other very well. He wasn't at a place where he says, you know, and it used to be that somebody would have made a comment like that, I would have thrown him in my marshal or bailiff's jail for contempt, you know. And I smiled and I says, yeah, but now you know the truth and you're an honorable man now, you know. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me, so he says, you know, and he shook his finger at me and he actually spilled his soda accidentally while we were chatting. But it makes a point. It's very, very important that we come to the place where we can educate the jurist in a tactful, candid, and succinct manner about what's happening so that they understand it without taking offense. And the issue is that the moment that we embarrass them or say something that didn't go over very well, they're now on the defensive. And the chances of us winning anything are slim to non-existent the moment they're on the defensive. It's very, very important. I have a saying that I like to use. This is, you never, ever, ever leave somebody unnecessarily offended or as an enemy. If somebody's going to, you know, if you're going to embarrass somebody or offend them, you better have an awful good reason. It's not something to take lightly, embarrassing somebody. There's a lot of individuals that are bold and unkind, and overly thoughtful citizens don't care about embarrassing or leaving somebody offended. Some of them live their life quite pleasantly, not caring about who they hurt or they offend, and they live their life very abrasively. And it's very common to see them find themselves in an unkind situation where they reap what they sowed. One time I just says, it was so bad, and I says, Your Honor, and I started laughing. I says, I'm going to have to object to that. I don't think you, and I says, I sincerely believe, I don't think, and then I said, let me correct that. I sincerely believe that you didn't mean to say that. And he looked at me very funny. He says, go ahead. And I says, because that would instantly violate your oath of office and mean that you could no longer serve in this this trial, and that a federal marshal might have to remove you from the courtroom for the fact that you no longer can exercise the authorities and privileges and rights of office. You know, and I laughed. And I says, that's why it makes me laugh, because a judge of your note, a justice of your note, would absolutely never risk anything like that happening. And he started to chime in on me, and two people stood up in the court and opened up their jackets to reveal federal marshal badges. I didn't have to explain it to the justice. He started laughing. He says, you're right, I made a mistake. There's a little bit of food for thought, Jennifer.
Jennifer?
Are you still there?
Did we lose?
Hello, Jennifer? Did we lose you? I believe we might have lost her. Are you still there, Michael? Hello?
Well, that was an interesting thing that happened. I just got knocked off my own call. John, you there?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Jennifer, you there? I show you're unmuted. Well, okay. Jennifer just texted me, says that she can't. All right, Jennifer, hang up and call back in, please. That'll probably fix the problem. I don't understand what's going on. While we're waiting for Jennifer to come in, I believe Bill was next. So let me unmute Bill's phone here. Bill, are you available? Are you clear?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And John, you touched on the term organic person, but you did not describe that or define it. You want to do that?
That's a natural man. In the Declaration of Independence, paragraph 2 starts out, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. A man is created, into different entities are created by different entities. In this case, I believe in an intelligent designer that created this third rock from the sun that we call planet Earth and home and the whole universe, and that he's largely in charge. And there are other entities that create entities, like corporate entities. They're created by government entities. And to that end, if you read that 26 U.S.C. 74 or 7343 that I talked about earlier, if you just go ahead and put that on your notes to look up later, 26 U.S.C. 7343, it defines what a person is versus an organic or a man. I say organic meaning that they have a pulse, they can fog a mirror, and they have the breath of life in them.
So the organic term organic, separating the natural man from the government-created person.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. I just thought it would be good for you to explain that because that's what I thought you were talking about. But there were other people that texted me that I'd invited to this call who asked me about that, and I said, "Well, ask him." So I figured I'd let you explain it.
Yeah, okay. was that a satisfactory explanation for you?
Yeah, it was satisfactory for me, and I'm hopeful that the people that texted me and asked me what the organic person meant.
Right, right.
would have their question clarified.
Okay, is there any other questions I can answer for you?
No, that's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Jennifer, are you back yet? Have you raised your hand yet? Press star 2 if you have. All right, we'll return to you. Next is Kent. Kent, can you hear us?
We can hear you. I can hear you.
Good.
Good evening, Mike.
Go right ahead. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Mike. Good evening, John. Thank you for the talk this evening, John. You were talking about a handful of things that must be done in preparation for a trial. Could you tell us where or to what extent you rate the importance of discovery, and that being Rod's admissions and production of documents is specifically what I'm talking about, in relation to other procedures in preparation for trial, and then also tell us as to what extent local rules, when it comes to the federal circuits, local rules and also internal operating procedures play into the formula to be used with the federal rules of civil procedure.
That's a very good point, Kent. The discovery has evolved in a federal criminal case. Discovery has evolved from something very different than in a civil case. In a civil case, you can propound interrogatories and denials or admissions, and where the individual is required to admit or deny in their admissions, and you're normally allowed 30 admissions and 15 interrogatories per package that you submit. And you can ask some very embarrassing questions. And presently, remember that one case I was saying, one of the cases that we said that the IRS, we didn't do very well. Well, the individual, I was brought on board. I wasn't brought on board till the case was half over. But we're going back over to the federal prosecutor and filing a 42 U.S.C. 1983 complaint against her. And the interrogatories and admissions are the case where we're going to use those when we're done to file a new appeal on the original conviction, because there's things that you can find out, you can get in a civil case that they literally refuse to provide in a criminal case. But the interrogatories and admissions in a civil case are extremely, extremely critical. As far as the criminal goes, they've got to the place where they've defined a minimum number of items that need to be addressed in criminal discovery, except that now prosecutors are saying that that's all we're required to produce. You know, in the items that were additional previously, it was the intent of the Circuit Court of Appeals to make certain that these didn't get left out and that they were affirmed and approved as discovery has now been unfruitfully been given a situation where they're using that to deny the arrest of the discovery. So discovery is extremely important. In most cases, especially in a civil case, like a 42 U.S.C. 1983 or 42 U.S.C. 1985, that discovery, I believe, is the equivalent to the jury instructions and the opening and closing statements in a criminal. I believe that the whole case can stand or fall on the discovery in the civil. Does that make any sense, or does that kind of answer your question?
It answers part of it. So what would you say in a criminal case that it would stand or fall on, then, if you're saying in a civil case it might be very well the discovery, the jury instructions, and the opening and closing statements?
The biggest item is the motion to quash for lack of in personam jurisdiction. That that is the biggest thing in the criminal. And for those of you who have already corrected your status, you're clear on the concept of the difference between on some of the jurisdictions. The rest of you, we need to work on getting you guys getting your status corrected and getting you educated so that you understand how critical and critically important jurisdictional issues are. But the motion, challenging jurisdiction is the first and primary and most important motion of any and all. And then the discovery, and almost with the same weight, the opening and closing statements and the jury instructions, and immediately behind that, voir dire, because voir dire sets the table for, by asking the questions, the moment you ask that question, does anybody think that the juror is going to forget that and not remember it and walk away from it? Not. They're going to be thinking about that through the whole trial. And what you did was you quietly just set the table for the whole trial by the voir dire, by the questions you ask the jury during jury selections.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that answer. Thank you. The other part of the question was, what is the weight of the federal rules of having to use the federal rules of civil procedure against local rules that are propounded by each federal circuit, and also the IOPs, which a lot of people don't even know exist?
Hey, are you either in New York or Arizona?
No, but I'm right next to New York, so.
Oh, okay. Well, those two are the worst on rules, local rules of procedure. those two, Pennsylvania and Massachusetts are the two runner-up. When it comes to local rules, in fact, you'll find out that they don't even use the same style as the rest of the U.S. District Court system does. You know what style is, right? That's the header that comes on the first page that has the title of the court at the top. It has the parties on the left, and on the right it has the case and the pleading designation or title.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the there are a lot of U.S. district courts that have their own local rules of civil procedure, but you all of a sudden when you look into it, they especially if you're using Arizona, they require that the top six lines of the pleading be vacant on the first page, and then some demand that the person preparing the pleading put their information on the top of the pleading, regardless of who the parties are. Local rules of civil procedure, as much as you can, try to comply with those and try to research them out, search and research so that you know them well, because those folks, the fact that they went through the trouble of making local rules of civil procedure, they're almost jealously proud of their own procedures. And if you don't do it the way their own is done, sometimes you have this strange feeling like you're talking to a wall.
Well, let me ask you to clarify something if I could. So would not Massachusetts be in the first federal circuit as opposed to New York being in the second circuit? And I believe Pennsylvania being in the third circuit, or am I misstating the circuit numbers on that?
I
don't know.
I don't remember off the top of my head. I wish I could answer that for you at the moment. I'm not able to answer that. I'd have to look it up.
So when you say, for example, New York is, you know, the worst on local rules together with Arizona, so you would separate, are you separating New York as a state out of the Second Circuit and saying that, quote unquote, division of the Second Circuit is worse than another state that's in the Second Circuit? I just want to be clear on
that. They've become New York. I may have had a few brushes with them, and they have become very poignantly jealous about their local rules, where Pennsylvania is a close runner-up, but they're not as bad. And the person that commented on how bad they were or were not, to me, was Sydney.
Now, the last part of that question is, when you made the statement about the local rules and knowing the local rules and how to apply them, et cetera, or how they apply, would you also include what they call, I believe they call them their IOPs, in with that local rules?
Yeah, most people don't know the IOPs exist even.
Well, that's
what I'm saying. Yeah, it's very important. First thing you do is find out if they do exist for that individual court, okay?
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for your response. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mike.
All righty. Let's go now to, my guy, Johnny Ringo. Johnny Ringo.
Michael, how you doing?
Doing good, sir. How about yourself?
I can't complain. Nobody listens to me anyways.
You don't need a huckleberry.
No. I guess I've been schooled by some pretty intelligent individuals, and they always told me never ask a question unless you already know the answer to. But I'm kind of inquisitive. I got a couple questions for John.
That's only in court.
By federal law, an individual is entitled to be notified of a commencement of a grand jury in order to issue a warrant against a person to be prosecuted. Have you ever experienced such a notification in your time that you have practiced law?
Now, you're assuming that I practice.
Well, you've been involved, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Twice I've been made aware of that somebody got notification that a grand jury proceeding was convened against them. But most of the time, what they do is they claim the prosecutor, claims that it could be a risk of flight, and so they want the proceedings sealed until the individual can or cannot be legally served with a warrant for their arrest.
Okay.
It's a quote-unquote avoiding flight.
Yeah. By law, you've got to you can present your case to the grand jury, but I've yet to have anybody be given the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, that's interesting, because in the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, was it 6B2 states that an individual can object to a grand juror's selection, and they have the right to it states a whole bunch of rights that are always that all precede the grand jury hearing, doesn't it?
That is correct, because most of that executive administrators just brush that aside because they think they're God when they sit up on that bench. And my second question is, the IRS is a foreign entity. How can a foreign entity have jurisdiction in the U.S.?
Either you have studied elsewhere or you've been studying both Bernie and GW's material, because they technically the IRS is part of the corporation and that corporation, while it didn't come into effect till the late 1800s, but in Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution for the United States, it says the United States will guarantee to every state in the Union a republican form of government, indicating that there's a difference between the United States and the several states.
That is correct.
It also does not point out the fact that there is now a corporation doing business for the United States, which is actually 2 degrees of separation. Okay, so at this juncture, you're right. The Enablement Act that brought Alaska into the Union identified, and also the CFR and USC both identify Alaska as a separate country. And in 1959, those documents were made very clear and is still identified as a separate country.
Correct.
So the United States would be a foreign corporation, or the United States would be a foreign government. The corporation would be a foreign corporation, and the IRS doing business underneath the foreign corporation would be a foreign business corporation. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right. You're 100% right.
What else may I do to be an asset or blessing for you, my honored brother?
That's about it. I just rather inquisitive.
The only question you don't ask, the only question is a dumb question, is the one you don't ask. Except in court. Always in court, if you're going to ask a question, make absolutely certain you know the answer before you ask.
You're 100% correct.
I got a real quick story that I want to share, Johnny, with you and the audience here tonight. Young man, fellow, I call him my friend, Chappie. Has a firsthand experience on this. He was the defendant, and the information provider that he was working through at that time was David Merlin. David Merlin was the second information provider that I marketed for a number of years, good 7-8 years. Anyways, point is, criminal complaints had been filed and served on the Judiciary Committee with several congressmen, also with our favorite Texan, whose son is now a congressman, Ron Paul, and several others. You're laughing, Johnny. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Exactly.
Okay. He walked in. He was invited to actually address the grand jury. And he made like 35 copies of a criminal complaint that David Merlin had crafted that he was a co-complainant to. And he walked in The judge was up there. The prosecutor was up there. And they expected Chappie to walk in trembling and fearful. Chappie walks in strutting like the peacock that he is and said to the grand jury, I want to thank you for this opportunity, for allowing me to come in here before an indictment is handed down to give me the opportunity to charge this man, and he points to the judge and points to the prosecutor from the IRS, from the Department of Justice, naming him by name, said, I want you to thank you for allowing me to share with you these criminal complaints that I have filed against these two men, and he starts handing them out. And the long story and the short is, they took those copies in with them and they deliberated upon those criminal complaints that dotted the I's, crossed the T's, gave book, chapter, and verse of everything that he stood for with regards to what the law said, and they delivered a null process. They did not indict him, and he hasn't been indicted since that I'm aware of.
No, he hasn't.
There you go. So I just thought you'd all like to hear that story. All right. Johnny, anything else? We're going to go to Nicholas and then back to Jennifer.
No, go right ahead. I'm all done. Thanks anyways.
All right. Thank you so very much. Nicholas, thank you for your patience. Kind man.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Perfectly clear.
All right. First, I want to agree with you, and I've kind of experienced it myself with, you know, regular officers. You know, you got to be respectful, polite, treat them as a fellow human being if you want to be treated, you know, nicely. First and foremost, I've had a couple IRS dealings, one with a fraudulent business and then another with a, I guess, fraudulent business. I didn't really know how to deal with it, so I kind of just let them go into the past. I don't know if you have any advice with dealing with that moving forward.
Go ahead, Nicholas. You still there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you just laid it out. Go ahead. Keep talking.
Oh, I was just asking if you could give any input on potentially, you know, dealing with a previous employer that was fraudulent or two previous employers that were fraudulent.
What would you mean by fraudulent?
Well, one was, you know, I kind of let it die in the past because I was working for him for cash and not reporting it. And then they just withheld my tips as well as like $100 or more in tips. And then also my paycheck. And they just said, you know, gave some excuses for why they could not pay me. And then the other was the business had like three different addresses, no physical location besides, you know, no headquarters physical location. And I reported it to the IRS, I think, or I was young and my grandma reported it for me, I think, two times, but nothing was ever done.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons why nothing ever gets done. One of them is that there is something genuinely going wrong, and somebody's being protected, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And somebody chooses to overlook what's happening. The other is that, and this is the most common, the workload that they have is so unbelievable that they don't have the time to address certain complaints. And during the 2020 event, I had three election judges that were, they ignored prosecution in Michigan. And the prosecutor's exact words
what she told me, and I'll just tell you, John, I've got murderers, rapists, and robbers ahead of this individual. I will take the complaint. But she said, and she walked me into her office, and she showed me an inbox that had three stacks next to it that were both, or that were all over a foot high. And I says, you're attempting to use this to make your point? And she goes, John, if that doesn't make my point, nothing does. And she pointed out, that's my workload, none of the people that work for me. And so there are times when justice isn't served because someone, quote unquote, doesn't have the resources to prosecute. I'm sorry about that, but that's the case.
So I guess kind of the last thing you said before you put me on the call was similar to what I was thinking about doing. My dad called up TW and, you know, got him to talk to me, and he sent me Felicia Beverly's video on what people can do using the IRS to audit and kind of protect themselves from the courts, you know, describing the courts as banks, you know, there to collect a debt, and talking about, you know, the difference in, you know, capital letters, lowercase letters, and, you know, jurisdictions. And what they were saying was to file IP PIN form, I believe it's 15227, and that way, you know, it's most likely to dismiss the case, especially, you know, civil traffic, which is what I'm dealing with right now. But there's also the W-4 packet, in which she was saying that kind of helps assure, you know, if you can file that on, you know, whoever to get, you know, audit done. And I'm still learning a lot of the stuff, but I was just thinking about, you know, trying to do as much as I can in my case, along those lines.
By the way, don't feel bad. I'm still learning as well. And hopefully all of us, anybody who has a pulse and can fog a mirror, is still learning, brother.
Yeah, it's all very confusing, but... Together.
Well, there's a lot of information out there, and it's very important that we I don't know everything. I wish I did. I do know people that know a lot more than I do, and when it comes to pinch time, that's what I rely upon.
Yeah.
You know, and there's times where you'll hear me say, I'm not prepared to answer that, or I'm not able to answer that. Now, whether it's I have a question regarding the application to their specific situation, or maybe I truly lack subject matter material on that, if I don't know, I think it's the responsible and correct thing to identify to the people, to the student and the people you're working with, that, hey, I'm light in that area. I need to do some research. I'm not prepared to answer that. And rather than just shoot from the hip and give something.
Makes sense. Yeah, I'm planning on talking or asking some questions on Saturday and Monday following. So.
Sick 'em doggy. You go, brother.
Right on. And then I heard you saying earlier, just last thing, I heard you saying earlier that the affidavit is pretty important, and my dad was kind of saying that to me as well, that I should fill out an affidavit to, you know, claim my, you know, being as a man.
The affidavit is de facto testimony and evidence that can be entered into any court. Okay. Very, very important. Do you have any other questions, my brother?
I think that'll be it. Thank you so much.
Good evening, sir.
All right, you as well.
All right. Jennifer is next and last to work with. But before I open up her, well, I've already opened up her mic, but before I ask, bring her forward, I want to read something that I knocked out when I felt inspired just a moment ago from John, when he was talking about putting together basically a three apples brief on jurisdiction. And I'd like to read it to you. It's one page.
Please.
Just over. Once we were colonists, Your Honor, once we were colonists subject to a king, we were citizens to a colony, a colonial citizen, as it were. And then we made our declaration for independence. And immediately we became state citizens under the Articles of Confederation. And there we had one people, one land. It was divided into 13 separate, sovereign, independent states. Actually, they were separate countries. 8 years later, our founding fathers met in Philadelphia. And there they amended the Articles of Confederation. They renamed it a constitution for the United States of America. The several Union states had matters adjudicated therein under Article 3 to this federal constitution with a guaranteed republic form of government. Internal, and I use that word specifically, internal to these Union of states, however, another government was created. And this government, its land, and its people, they're found under Article 1, Section 8 to this federal constitution, where a republican or republic form of government is not applicable. Actually, it became something called a democracy, although in my opinion, it appears more like an oligarchy. SCOTUS Justice John Marshall Harlan, in which he predicted much of what has occurred throughout the ages, tells us in 1901 in the Downs versus Bidwell decision, 182 U.S. 244, quote, "The idea prevails with some, indeed it has found expression in arguments at the bar, that we have in this country substantially two national governments, one to be maintained under the Constitution with all the restrictions, the other to be maintained by the Congress outside and independently of that instrument, by exercising such powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to." And it continues. And then before that, U.S. versus Cruikshank, 92 U.S., 542. This is 1875. It said, quote, "We have in our political system a government of the United States and a government of each of the several states. Each one of these governments is distinct from the others, and each has its own citizens who owe its own allegiances and whose rights within its jurisdiction it must protect. The same person may be at the same time a citizen of the United States and a citizen of a state. But his rights of citizenship under one of these governments will be different from those he has under the other. In a unique case regarding this traffic issue, we're told in Hendricks versus Maryland, SC Reporters Round 610 through 625, quote, "A U.S. citizen upon leaving the District of Columbia becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have the common law right, ... of a citizen of one of the several states," end quote. So here's the question before this bench. Would this jurist consider it important, the moving party, this state, establish upon the record both the land jurisdiction as well as the personam jurisdiction? That's my question, Your Honor.
And you hammered that out while I was talking?
Yes, sir.
I think that's worthy of applause.
Okay.
My humble respects and humble regards. That is so spot on, it's shocking.
Okay, so you can apply it how you want. You can remove Hendricks. Remember I had said earlier I used the word internal to these Union states? Well, now, Your Honor, we have something called the Internal Revenue Service. And then I would quote other cases that basically say the same thing that Hendricks does. They have no ground to stand on with something so short and sweet. It's a bullseye. And it's yours, John. Sending it over
okay.
to you now.
Okay. Moving on to Jennifer.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the question I was asking when you couldn't hear me was, are judges elected? Is that why he was afraid to be honorable? Because he wanted to be, and who elects them? Because I don't understand how, if he was doing the right thing by the law, if the people were electing the judges, wouldn't they want to elect him being a honorable judge? When we're talking, we're talking about the two judges you were talking to at the pool, and one said he didn't know, and the other said he knew, but he was afraid he wouldn't be elected if he let the cat out of the bag, type of thing.
Yeah, there. That was a that was an eye opening event for me. And I was surprised that they were so cavalierly candid with me at the time. I didn't deserve that type of confidence or candor, but they honored me with it. But it, the one thing it did do was it opened my eyes to realize a lot of the truth in the situation. And since then, I've had the honor and the privilege of interfacing with a few other gowns and gavels and realizing how they address life on their side of the fence. And it's proved to be quite interesting, Jennifer. I at this juncture, I'm learning an awful lot that some of it, I have to say, it's so shocking that enough years back it would have curled my toenails. Some of the things I've learned, I understand why they say what they do, why they do what they do, why they make the judgments they do. I don't believe it's right. In fact, I think some of it's dead wrong. But I have learned why some things occur, and it's there are things that I have to admit that I've learned that occur that there's no good, honorable reason why they should be allowed to occur the way they do. So to that end, I'll say their justice can sometimes be a tough thing. And I've listened to some individuals share their personal points of view that have, one of them literally, it scared me so bad that I had to go to the little boy's room because I had to throw up. I didn't want to learn that some of the basis of the justice that is levied and allowed or pervade. But I do know now more than I did then. And, I try to figure out how to work within now between, the founding fathers' documents and their commission, i.e. through the Articles of Confederation, the Declaration of Independence, or the Constitution, or the Bill of Rights, and those that have to apply the law and survive to be able to sleep. And I say that because some justices indicated that in their particular jurisdiction that a sheriff and a magistrate judge had both been removed from the equation, and when a certain group disagreed with the sheriff's arrest and the justice's application of the law. and they didn't banter anything. It's just that's the night the lights went out in Georgia. I don't know if you're familiar with that reference, but
or something.
Yeah. So yeah, there's that, as bad as that sounds, Jennifer, it's real.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to have a quiet discussion, personal discussion over a tall pitcher of lemonade, maybe I can go into a little bit more detail for you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks. Now, how do you think I could get the court to respond before the trial to my letter that said you can't go ahead with a trial until you answer my jurisdiction?
Jennifer, good question. I am glad you asked, and I've been waiting for you to answer that or waiting for me to catch up with you. Okay. there's a little statute that makes some rumors allegation that once jurisdiction's been challenged, there can be no further proceedings. So
right.
what you do is you just take that in your pocket with you to the hearing and say, oh, did you guys want to start this? Did I miss something? We had challenged jurisdiction. Have we covered that yet? Or do you guys need another continuance? And you ask them, do you need another continuance? They'll get to the rat killing real fast, and jurisdiction will get addressed, and usually about that time your trial will be over because they'll dismiss it.
So it will be at the trial that I have to do that.
That's the next thing in your calendar, isn't it?
Yeah, the trial.
Trial.
I need to know jurisdiction before the trial, because you can't put me in a trial
where you don't have in personam jurisdiction.
Right. And also, do I get to choose the jury in a traffic court trial? Or is
the traffic court trial, most of those only have a 6-person jury. They're not, because it's not a capital crime, they're not required to do the usual 12-person jury. But in a matter of $20 or more, the right to a trial by jury will be preserved. Some of them, I have had some of those traffic courts where they did allow jury selection and did allow voir dire. They didn't have a lot of they didn't have a high caseload and a lot of people to work on. So what happened was that they allowed voir dire and questioning the jury selection and the defendant to choose a jury.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the biggest thing about the jury is asking thought-provoking questions during voir dire that you don't tell them anything. Judges and prosecutors have a nasty habit of objecting and getting upset. But when you ask questions and you say, you have to remember there's a difference between rhetorical and non-rhetorical questions. And so what you do is when you're speaking there, you say, I'd like you to keep this question in the back of your mind. Have they proven jurisdiction in this tax matter? Have they proven jurisdiction in this traffic matter? And if they have not proven jurisdiction in your mind, then you have to return a verdict of not guilty. But if in your mind they have proven jurisdiction, then you must consider the possibility. And I say, I don't say then you must return a guilty verdict. I say then you must consider the possibility of a guilty verdict. You must consider the possibility, not just go ahead and do it, okay?
Right. But the jury won't understand that I'm an American national and not in their jurisdiction, so that's the issue.
That's correct. The jury and the judge and even the prosecutor may not understand jurisdiction. And I shared with you, I've shared with you before that I had a gown, and I used the term gown to refer to the feminine and the gavel to return to the masculine. I had a gown comment that you've heard Michael talk, use the term three apples brief once or twice tonight, and that's indicative of a group of briefs that I am working on, that I'm preparing, that I to simplify matters, that this one justice, she looked at that regarding wet sign notes for foreclosure, and she said, I never thought of it this way. I never considered it this way. She says, John, you need to reduce this to a third grade reading level, and make, because she says, I realized I was wrong in four rulings that she has made. She says she had to go back and overturn her own rulings. And so what happened was that Jennifer, she realized that what was wrong. We did it tactfully and pleasantly, and she felt so personally convicted that of the wrong that she told me that she was going to overturn her own rulings. And she's now, one of them, the couple that was in jail, she has since overturned it and had them released. Another one that he wasn't in jail, but she's overturned it, and of all things, the case is restarting as of about a week and a half ago, because the back then the plaintiffs now are complaining that because she she made the plaintiffs restore the house and the property to the couple that was. They were in jail for quote unquote criminal trespass because they refused to leave the property that they that had been foreclosed on, and the sheriff removed them physically, and they might have accidentally been defending themselves as well. So it turned into, it wasn't a Ruby Ridge moment. Don't think that. But nonetheless, they. The issue was such that she created a little bit of controversy and some problems. Okay, but see, we educated them tactfully, without being confrontational. And I'm learning that in the last 5, 8, 10 years, I've learned that being tactful and non-confrontational is a very, very good way to proceed. And if you have to be confrontational, like I mentioned with that one judge that I started laughing, I says, oh, Your Honor, I know you would never consider doing that, you know, and I started laughing, you know, and I explained everything very lock, knee, step, monkey motion explicitly while saying if that happened, then this would have to occur. Then a federal marshal, if he witnessed it, it would be a crime. You'd lose your tenure and everything else. And he didn't know that I had not one but two federal marshals in the courtroom at the time.
Mm. So do you think you'll finish your little third grade jurisdictional
brief
before February of 2023? When I have to go to trial?
You know what? Amazing things have happened. My workload is pretty high right now. But you know what? I actually spent some time on that 3 nights ago, and I spent about I worked through the night on it. Actually spent 11.5 hours on it, working through the night and just doing research. And Jennifer, I'll ask a favor.
Mm-hmm.
That intelligent designer that created this solar system and universe and the third rock from the sun that we call planet Earth,
mm-hmm.
that guy, I rely upon him for a lot of wisdom. If you can ask him for help for me, I'd appreciate it.
I would love to do that for you.
Because there, I kid you not, there are miracles of epiphany when, you know, when we came up with the question about unlawful carry of a firearm, wrongful carry, wrongful configuration, all that. Your Honor, where in the Constitution is it excluded that my right to keep and bear a firearm in that school ground, let alone your courtroom?
Mm.
You know, when we came up with that one, that is the essence of a 74-page brief turned into 26, turned into 12, turned into 5, turned into 3 pages, turned into 1 single line over a 14-year period. That's where that question came from, girl. You know, and it reveals in that one moment how, you know, that the 28,654 statutes, the 2,073 U.S. District Court of Appeals decisions that are all, they're all invalid. It reveals, the one question reveals them just like that.
Hmm.
Okay, so that's what, you know, you've heard the term writer's block?
Yep.
Okay, well, when somebody's writing like a fiction novel or something, well,
mm-hmm.
trying to figure out, knowing that there is a way, that there is a responsibility to iterate it and propound it properly, coming up with the right answer, that, you know, and the question to make it simple, that's the hard part, and that's what I'm working on right now. I've, you know, you obviously heard Michael and myself and others share other information providers, and you've studied, and you know most of these statutes. I know a lot of the statutes myself. But getting it to the point where we can ask a question so that somebody will just, you know, kind of tap their forehead and say, "Oh, holy shaving cream, Batman!" You know, and the epiphany and the, you know, the eureka moment, and the you know, the lights, both headlights come on bright, and they say, "You know what? We got to dismiss this, or we got to overturn this. This is wrong." You know, if we can get it to that point, that's what's important. Okay.
I also realize I've decided what I'm going to do for next year's 1040. And I'm going to do what basically you suggested. I'm going to send them a 1040, but write, "I'm not a U.S. citizen, so is it illegal for me to send
you..." Is it wrong? Is it wrong to file a 1040 as if I was a citizen responsible for it? And yeah. To that end, could you please confirm that I am or am not responsible
right.
for filing a 1040, including the statutes, including the relevant statutes? That's
right.
That's the questions we ask.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
And it's really important. It's really important because you have, again, remember everyone, you have 3 definitions of United States. 3. The second definition, if you are that definition, whether it's United States land that you're on or you're a United States people, whichever, a person, you are subject to the Congress. You are liable for that tax. It's law. But if you're definition number 3 or if you're definition number 1, you're not. So the way John phrased it is perfect. He doesn't address the controversy. He puts the onus upon the accuser to establish the record on the record. Is that correct, John?
Yeah, we ask the question, and in an honest, considerate, respectful way, in a very thought-provoking way. And one of the things that we include in my 540 package that I do is that we include in all my search and research, I have failed to find any place in the California statute tax code where I'm compelled to file a 540. Could you please help me could you please help me by sharing this with me? And, you know, to date, we have yet to get a single response.
So I need to do that for my.
Do you include the affidavit, the political status affidavit, with it to help the IRS make that determination?
I'm going to.
John?
Okay. I have learned a whole bunch of new things. There was a new policy that came down 3 weeks ago it came in the form of an internal memo. Somebody at the State Department shared it with me on Monday. There are some things that before I give an answer on that, I want to finish this point of research. It may take a week or two, or at least a couple of days. Can we defer that until I'm able to give a better or more responsible answer?
Not a problem.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Listen, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. John, you made an outstanding presentation. I thank you, and I stand in awe sometimes at the poetry that comes out of your mouth. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your good questions. I want to remind you once again, tomorrow night, please show up. We're going to have our new speaker, new information provider, share with you how you can either as an employee operate through an LLC or as a business operate through an LLC that properly arranged will yield zero tax liability on your part. So it's going to be a very good call. I encourage you to be there. I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.